are coming. And there's nothing you can do to stop them.
Kia ora, I'm Sharon Brett Kelly. Today, a Chinese sci-fi novel, Zombie Projects, Two Tails Wagging a Dog. No, this episode of The Detail is not about a dystopic futuristic TV show, although it has plenty of dramas.
Prepare yourself for something very strange.
We're talking about the Fast Track Approvals Bill, the proposed solution to our sluggish growth.
We want more roads, we want more wind farms, we want more homes, more solar, more geothermal, more mines, more commerce, and more opportunity for New Zealanders to get building.
The government's one-stop shop for getting things moving. Cut red tape, make it easier to build infrastructure and other big projects.
Fast-tracking legislation, is this so you can dig it up and dam it up?
Big day. We are turbocharging the legislation that David Parker originally developed, Fast Track. The underlying philosophy of the Fast Track today is we're moving from cancel economics to can-do economics.
But what about claims that it is bad news for diversity, of conflict of interest and cronyism for the unprecedented power it gives to three ministers, Simeon Brown, Chris Bishop and Shane Jones, who will have the absolute final say? Even some on the right are alarmed, including former National Minister Simon Upton.
The Parliamentary Commissioner for the Environment says the bill lacks environmental safeguards and ministers should not be the final decision makers.
So before we find out what it's got to do with a Chinese sci-fi story, let's do a recap on what this bill is with Farah Hancock from RNZ's in-depth team.
It's supposed to fast-track projects, to make projects happen quicker, because there's been some studies that projects are taking really long and costing a lot of money to get consents to get across the line. But this bill, it does more than just fast-track projects. It also sidesteps a whole bunch of different acts and legislations, and it's supposed to be for a regionally or nationally important infrastructure or development projects. So we might be talking about things like roads, a wind farm, a fish farm, irrigation dams, or we could be talking about a coal mine. So
projects which can take, what, months, years to get go through the whole approvals process?
I talked to somebody from the Wind Energy Association and he said, look, it can take up to 9 or 10 years to get consents for a wind farm, but it only takes 2 or 3 years to build one. So, you know, there is definitely a problem there, which this fast track hopes to address.
Okay, would it be guaranteed that process, the 9 years, would cut down to a shorter period?
They do have a time frame on it. I think it's around 6 months, roughly.
Oh.
So a lot quicker. And then they'll get a consent which is valid for maybe 3 years. So you can't just sit on, you know, permission for a long time. You've got to get cracking on getting it done.
Well, you know, it sounds good. It's what we need, isn't it? We need it to get our economy moving. So what about this legislation is bugging people?
Yeah, so we have had fast track legislation before. There was a COVID-19 fast track bill, and that was different in three really key ways. So first of all, it only allowed projects to go through the RMA, whereas this fast track lets them go through sort of 10 different acts or sets of regulations. So it's very wide and far reaching. The other thing which is different is ministers have the final say on projects. The other COVID one, it was expert panels. And then finally in this one, and this is where people are getting quite concerned, or one of the reasons people are getting quite concerned, is that environment seems to take a back seat in this one. So environmental groups are really, really worried. They're saying the fast track bill is, you know, the war on nature gone nuclear.
We're parties to a number of international agreements, including the Paris one on climate change, of course, but also agreements on biodiversity, on renewables, on preventing coal extraction, and a lot of those are arguably being breached.
Because there's no mention of the environment in the purpose of the Act, and then when these applications, projects are being considered by an expert panel, those panel members need to take in the purpose of the Fast Track Act above everything else. So they need to think about getting these infrastructure and development projects off the ground more than they need to think about the purpose of the Wildlife Act or the Conservation Act or the Crown Minerals Act.
Okay, but usually when you have these processes, they do still have to go through a number of steps, don't they? So what is the structure of this that's so different to, you know, previous processes?
There's a few differences. Ministers can refer projects to an expert panel. So they do have to consider a set of criteria. Then it goes to the expert panel. The expert panel assesses the application, and when they're assessing the application, they're very limited in who they can speak to. They can speak to the applicant, they can speak to people directly affected, but they can't go out to the public and get public input. They can't go to environmental NGOs like Forest and Bird or Greenpeace or some of these groups, or Environmental Defence Society is another one. Some of these groups which, you know, have the legal resource to look into some of these plans and go, well, it shouldn't be done because of this and this needs to be mitigated. So the expert panel won't be able to do that, which is quite unusual.
So is that effectively shutting out these organisations like Forest and Bird?
Absolutely.
Completely, the whole process, they do not have an opportunity to make a submission or to challenge something.
They've had the opportunity, like the public has, to make a submission on the bill itself. Now, those closed the other day, but they can't make submissions on individual projects. And we don't know what those projects are yet. They haven't been announced, but they've been, the public and NGOs are shut out of that process, and that is a big concern for them.
Then we have three ministers. We have Simeon Brown, Chris Bishop, and Shane Jones. And they have the absolute final say.
Absolutely. So the expert panel will look at the applications and they will make recommendations, which might include, say, a mitigation, environmental mitigation. But these ministers can go, oh, no, those conditions are too onerous. You need to go back and rework those. And Chris Bishop the other day on the radio, he called this a safeguard.
We've kept that safeguard in place in our proposal.
What safeguard?
And that's something that... Well, the safeguard that ministers will be making the final decision on whether or not projects happen or not after the application of the permits and conditions.
It's not incorrect. It's a safeguard for the applicants, but it's not necessarily a safeguard for the environment or the public.
And all three of them have a final say, or just one of them?
All three of them. And at times there can be the Minister for Conservation pulled in if there's something that affects conservation.
As Farrar says, submissions closed just over a week ago, but even then there was a bit of drama.
There was an 11th hour release of a list of recipients, a list of 200 groups or organisations who received a letter from Chris Bishop's office. Now the letter was, he says, wasn't an invitation to apply for Fast Track project approval, but it was just informing these groups of the process, and many of these groups had been in contact with him, he said. So he said he was releasing this in the interest of transparency. Forest and Bird have, they disagree with that, and they say that they made a complaint to the Ombudsman and the Ombudsman directed him to release the list before public submissions closed. They wanted the public submission period to extend so people could have a chance to look at that list and look at the names on it. Oh, that didn't happen. So it was, I think it got released at 3 p.m. or 2 p.m., something like that, and the submissions closed at midnight. So it was only a few hours. It squeaked in.
What's his reasoning for this?
He initially didn't want to release who might be on the project list because he said that knowing the projects might overwhelm the select committee when they were considering the bill. He thought they might get fixated on the exact projects in it rather than the bill in its entirety. And that's been his line. I mean, RNZ and I've made OAAs and been rejected as well. I've been told things are going to be released proactively. It hasn't happened yet.
And so he's got this list of 200. What about the other two ministers? Do they have a list?
I think it's all being run through his office, so I think that would be all encompassing. I have asked for all sorts of emails, and yeah, we'll see.
The same response, you've been told they'll be released proactively.
Yes.
Also last week, though, there were two appeals from two key people.
Well, a couple of big parliamentary watchdogs want major changes to the government's fast-track approvals bill.
One from the Parliamentary Commissioner for the Environment, Simon Upton, and then there's one from the Auditor General. And it's fair to say neither of them were glowing endorsements of the bill.
The Parliamentary Commissioner for the Environment says the bill lacks environmental safeguards.
I've got a little quote here from him. The bill lacks many environmental safeguards its predecessor legislation contained. Even the much maligned National Development Act of 1979 had more environmental checks and balances.
The Auditor General too, John Ryan, wants stronger management of ministerial conflicts of interest, a public record of the minister's decision-making on consents, and better transparency and accountability measures.
So conflicts of interest, what would they be, for example?
It could be a donor. So we don't know whether they're going to apply, but yeah, we allow businesses to donate to political parties and to political candidates in New Zealand. So there is a chance that somebody might make a donation and then a minister might refer a project to be fast-tracked. So this opens the door.
Well, the Labour Party says it risks leading to accusations of bias, particularly when political donations are thrown into the mix.
They're actually making the decision. So that then in turn opens them up to allegations of improper behaviour if they've had donations made by those different players. So it's a very strange thing for the ministers to want to open themselves up to.
So they're saying if that kind of thing happens, that the minister should declare a conflict of interest there and step away from being involved in that project.
They're saying some kind of safeguard should be written into the bill that handles that situation, because otherwise the public is going to be, you know, not very confident in the process.
It feels like this has got away on the government a little bit, the criticism and the backlash over it.
When I read the bill first time, I was quite surprised. I'm not a legal expert, so I got on the phone to a legal expert and they were also going, no, this is unprecedented, this hasn't happened before. And you know, I felt a little vindicated at my level of surprise. It is unusual how much power has been given to ministers. And there is a concern that prohibited things, like things which are prohibited under the Resource Management Act, could get approval under this bill. And then you're almost pitting the judiciary and the executive level of government against each other when you're letting the government go, we're ignoring a court decision, doesn't matter. So that is also very, very unusual.
So they would have power over those kind of court decisions as well.
They can choose to, I was going to call them zombie projects, could be.
What are zombie projects?
So zombie projects are projects which the courts have rejected and people have thought have gone away. They may have fought them for years and years and years. So the Tākuha mine, which is was an application to mine in an area where there's endangered or threatened wildlife. That's one which could come back. There's another one, the Ruatanifa irrigation dam. Now that got rejected because they wanted to swap conservation land with some other conservation land, and I think it was the Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. That's not. So that kind of stopped. It had resource consent, but it didn't get the, you know, the land swap it wanted. So there's worry that some of these projects, which people have fought for years and years and years and thought they'd won, could come back from the dead.
But how is the government responding to all of this?
There was an interview Chris Bishop gave the other day on RNZ in the morning. He mentioned that they could be looking at things during the select committee process.
The expert panel will be the ones doing the relevant permits and conditions. There will be a procedure to go back to ministers to either approve or decline that. I see that as a safeguard. Others would say that that gives ministers too much power. We can have that debate through the select committee process.
And I think it's been fairly loud. And it's been continual, so they've got to be noticing the concern.
Is there anybody who actually supports this, presumably the 200 that are on Chris Bishop's list?
Oh, look, infrastructure people who are interested in building things and on creating things, are really interested in this.
The chief executive of industry advocate Strattera, Josie Vidal, says processes can be sped up without having a negative impact on the environment.
The system is broken and it needs to be fixed. Mining is part of unlocking our economic growth. Doing something fast doesn't mean doing it badly. And there is absolutely no suggestion that any of the projects in the mining side will be at the expense of the environment.
But a lot of people who might be against this are going, look, we just need to fix RMA. Like, we'd be better putting our energy towards fixing the RMA, or if we're going to have this fast track, make it more like the COVID-19 fast track, which had, expert panels making the recommendations.
We're essentially doing government by amateurs. Ministers are professional politicians, but they are not often policy experts. They're not often content or subject experts in their field. And so they need to learn stuff. And often that advice comes from the officials.
Richard Shaw is a professor of politics at Massey University. He's talking about what it means when politicians have the final say.
The ministers are not obliged to take that advice. Ministers are forever acting contrary to the advice of officials. But it's unusual for a piece of legislation to be designed and perhaps to be passed, which essentially reduces the requirements upon ministers to take expert advice. So I think that you can absolutely say it is a reflection of the position that this government put before the electorate, before the election. But there is more to it than that with this specific piece of legislation. I think, there are broad areas of public policy. Monetary policy is another example where decisions are taken by impartial expert bodies for a really good reason or series of reasons. And one of those reasons is that there are just some areas we've collectively decided should not be overtly politicised. So, Sharon, I don't dispute the fact that the government has an electoral mandate to govern, but it is a little bit more complex than that. We do want our governments to have checks and we want them to have balances, particularly in a constitutional context such as ours, where we don't have many of the guardrails that apply in most other constitutional jurisdictions around the world. We don't have a chamber, a second chamber, a Senate or an upper house. We don't have a codified constitution. We don't have a judicial branch which has the constitutional right to rule on the constitutional probity of what governments do. So we have really powerful governments in this country. So we need to have other ways of holding them to account and to ensuring that decision making is transparent. And I think some of those norms and conventions are not met by this particular piece of legislation.
So if the three ministers were taken out, as in, their role as the decision makers was scrapped, if the Prime Minister has said that...
I've got every confidence that actually we do need ministerial decision making to cut through and to actually make a hard yes or a hard no.
But if he backed down and they were taken out as the, key decision makers, would that make a difference? Would this fast track legislation be more palatable to people?
It would depend on where that final executive authority was vested. If it was vested in the cabinet, as tends to be the case, but there was a subcommittee, a cabinet committee or an informal committee of ministers, including the environment minister who had an appropriate relationship with external expert advisory groups, I think that would absolutely go some way towards allaying the concerns of people. But I think there are both substantive concerns with the legislation and there are procedural concerns. And on the latter, one of the issues that critics of the legislation have is that the primary principle, the purpose of the legislation, is to facilitate the delivery of projects. There's no mention made of environmental sustainability or development issues. So you could theoretically maintain that purpose and rejig the reporting requirements, but it wouldn't entirely take away from the issues around process and public accountability and the truncation of timeframes for the consideration of official advice and the removal of opportunities for people to express their voices either for or against. So there would be other issues which would need to be attended to as well.
Richard, of all the things that have happened since this coalition government came into power, how does this particular piece of legislation, how does it sort of rank in all of the other stuff that's going on?
I think something is happening around this particular bill, which is crystallising both support for and concerns with the nature and the conduct of this administration. This particular piece of legislation is a very clear and unambiguous and explicit expression of executive power. You can come at that issue from many different points of view. One of them, the obvious one, is, well, that is why we have governments. We indirectly elect our governments to do things. I think, however, in the context of the contemporary or modern New Zealand politics, and in particular in the post-MMP era, what we expect from governments is a willingness and an ability and a political maturity to deal with other points of view. We expect to have some capacity to participate in the processes out of which the rules which govern us are made. And I think what this legislation is doing, I suspect it won't be the last, but it is certainly the first major piece of legislation which is crystallising views both for and against the government, both on substantive and procedural grounds. So it is significant in terms of its substance, but it's also significant as a marker of the political tone of this government.
You're scared. Your right to be scared.
So how does a Chinese sci-fi novel fit into all of this?
And I need your help.
I don't know how many of your listeners, Sharon, have read the science fiction that came out of China called The Three-Body Problem or watched the Netflix series, but The Three-Body Problem is a problem in which you have three bodies trying to orbit each other, and the orbits can never be stable. They are always chaotic and they are always unpredictable. And we're used to having two-party governments where there is a dominant partner and a junior partner, and the limits to which the junior partner can go to distinguish itself from the dominant coalition partner are reached pretty quickly, and it's pretty clear. This is a very different set of circumstances when there are two minor parties in a three-party coalition. They arguably, that's a structural arrangement which allows each of those parties, the small parties, to exercise more authority and to behave in ways which they may not get away with under the more classical two-party coalition arrangement. One, there are a couple of lessons from history. I think Mr. Luxon will not be unaware of these. The senior people within the National Party certainly won't be. The two occasions on which New Zealand first supported in a formal executive coalition, both the National Party and latterly the Labour Party, things went really badly for New Zealand First at the subsequent election. We New Zealand voters tend to punish small parties who prop up a larger party for all sorts of reasons. Largely because the policy offer of the small party gets diluted in the waves of policy which the larger party is able to put through because it is the dominant player in the coalition. And so the next election, who would know, it's quite some way away. Many things will happen between now and then. But the recent history in New Zealand suggests that small parties who go into formal coalitions tend to get punished by voters. And one of the reasons for that is because many New Zealand voters really dislike the perceived or actual wagging of dogs by little tails. And this coalition has two tails, a 6.8% tail and an 8.6% tail. And at the moment, both of those tails are doing an awful lot of wagging. Whether or not that continues to be the case, whether or not that has any impact upon the polling of the government, I think it is certainly a challenge to the authority and the skill of the Prime Minister. And that will be something that is that three-body problem that we have with this government will be an absolutely fascinating thing to track looking ahead.
That's it for today. Thanks to Farah Hancock and Richard Shaw. The Detail is supported by RNZ and NZ On Air. Alexia Russell produced this episode. Jeremy Ansell engineered it. I'm Sharon Brett Kelly. Mā te wā.